Great, I said to her. Good work, Roscoe. I'm out of here. Meet you back here at 6. You two stick close together, okay? Watch your backs. Where are you going? Finley said. I'm going for a drive in the country, I said. I left them there in the office and walked back to the entrance, pushed the door open and stepped outside, scanned north up the road. The plain sedan was still there, 75 yards away. The two guys were still in it, still watching. I walked over to the Bentley, unlocked the door and got in, nosed out of the parking lot and pulled out onto the county road, wide and slow. Drove slowly past the two guys and carried on north. In the mirror, I saw the plain sedan start up, saw it pull out and turn in the road. It accelerated north and fell in behind me, like I was towing it on a long, invisible rope. I slowed, it slowed. I sped up, it sped up. Like a game. Chapter 18. I drove past Eno's diner and rolled on north away from town. The plain sedan followed, 40 yards back, no attempt to hide. The two guys just cruised behind me, gazing forward. I swung west on the road to Warburton, slowed to a cruise. The plain sedan followed, still 40 yards back. We cruised west. We were the only things moving in that vast landscape. I could see the two guys in the mirror, gazing at me. They were spotlit by the low afternoon sun. The low, brassy light made them vivid. Young guys, Hispanic, loud shirts, black hair, very neat, very similar. Their car sat steadily in my wake. I cruised 7 or 8 miles. I was looking for a place. There were bumpy earth tracks off to the left and right every half mile or so. They led into the fields, looped around aimlessly. I didn't know what they were for. Maybe they led to gathering points where farmers parked machinery for the harvest, whenever that was. I was looking for a particular track I'd seen before. It led around behind a small stand of trees on the right-hand side of the road, the only cover for miles. I'd seen it from the prison bus on Friday, seen it again driving back in from Alabama, a sturdy stand of trees. This morning it had been floating on the mist, a little oval copse next to the road on the right, an earth track looping behind it, then joining up with the road again. I saw it a couple of miles ahead. The trees were a smudge on the horizon. I drove on toward it, snapped the glove compartment open and lifted the big automatic out, wedged it between the squabs on the seat next to me. The two guys followed, still 40 yards back. A quarter mile from the woods, I slammed the selector into second and floored the pedal. The old car gulped and shot forward. At the track, I hauled the wheel around and bounced and slewed the Bentley off the road, hurled it around to the back of the copse, jammed it to a stop, grabbed the gun and jumped, left the driver's door swinging open like I'd tumbled out and dived straight left into the trees. But I went the other way. I went to the right. I danced around the hood and hurled myself 15 feet into the peanut field and flattened into the ground. Crawled through the bushes and put myself on a level with where their car would have to stop on the track behind the Bentley. Pressed myself up against the brawny stalks, low down under the leaves on the damp red earth. Then I waited. I figured they'd dropped off maybe 60 or 70 yards. They hadn't tracked my sudden acceleration. I snicked the safety catch off. Then I heard their brown Buick. I caught the noise of the motor and the groan of the suspension. It bounced into view on the track in front of me. It stopped behind the Bentley, framed against the trees. It was about 20 feet away from me. They were reasonably smart guys. Not at all the worst I'd ever seen. The passenger had gotten out on the road before they turned in. He thought I was in the woods. He thought he was going to come at me from behind. The driver scrambled across inside the car and rolled out of the passenger door on the far side from the trees, right in front of me. He was holding a gun, and he knelt down in the dirt, his back turned to me, hidden from where he thought I was by the Buick, looking through the car at the woods. I'd have to make him move. I didn't want him to stay next to the car. The car had to stay drivable. I didn't want it damaged. They were wary of the cops. That had been the idea. Why would I drive all the way to the only woods for miles and then hide in a field? A classic diversion. They'd fallen for it without even thinking. The guy by the car was staring through at the woods. I was staring at his back. I had the Desert Eagle lined up on him, breathing low. His partner was creeping slowly through the trees, looking for me. Pretty soon he'd get right through and come right out into view. He arrived after about 5 minutes. He was holding a gun out in front of him. He dodged around the back of the Buick, kept distance between himself and the Bentley. He crouched down next to his partner, and they exchanged shrugs. Then they started peering at the Bentley, worried that I was lying on the floor or crouching behind the stately chrome radiator. The guy who'd just come out of the woods crawled along in the dirt, keeping the Buick between himself and the trees, right in front of me, staring under the Bentley, looking for my feet. He crawled the whole length of the Bentley. I could hear him grunting and gasping as he hauled himself along on his elbows. Then he crawled all the way back and knelt up again beside his partner. They both shuffled sideways and slowly stood up next to the Buick's hood. They stepped over and checked inside the Bentley. They walked together to the edge of the copse and peered into the darkness. They couldn't find me. Then they came back and stood together on the rough track, away from the cars, framed against the orange sky, staring at the trees, their backs to the field, their backs to me. They didn't know what to do. They were city boys, maybe from Miami. They wore Florida clothes. They were used to neon alleys and construction sites. They were used to action under raised highways in the trash-filled lots the tourists never saw. They didn't know what to do about a small copse standing alone in a million acres of peanuts. I shot them both in the back as they stood there. Two quick shots, aimed high up between their shoulder blades. The big automatic made a sound like hand grenades going off. Birds wheeled into the air from all around. The twin crashes rolled over the countryside like thunder. The recoils pounded my hand. The two guys were hurled forward off their feet, landed on their faces sprawled against the trees on the far side of the earth track. I raised my head and peered over. They had that slack, empty look that is left behind when life has departed. I held onto the gun and stepped over to them. They were dead. I had seen a lot of dead people, and these two were as dead as any of them. The big magnum shells had caught them high up on their backs, where the big arteries and veins are, going on up into the head. The bullets had made quite a mess. I looked down at the two guys in the silence and thought about Joe. Then I had things to do. I stepped back to the Bentley, clicked the safety on and tossed the Desert Eagle back on the seat, stepped over to their Buick and yanked the keys out, popped the trunk. I guess I was hoping to find something in there. I didn't feel bad about the two boys, but I was going to feel better still if I found something in there, like a silenced 22 automatic, or like four pairs of rubber overshoes and four nylon bodysuits, a few 5-inch blades, things like that. But I didn't find things like that. I found Spivey. He'd been dead a few hours. He'd been shot through the forehead with a 38 from close range. The revolver barrel must have been about 6 inches from his head. I rubbed my thumb across the skin around the bullet hole, looked at it. There was no soot, but there were tiny gunpowder particles blasted into the skin. They wouldn't rub off. That kind of tattooing means a fairly close range. 6 inches will do it. Maybe 8. Somebody had suddenly raised a gun, and the slow, heavy assistant warden hadn't been quick enough to duck. There was a scab on his chin where I'd cut him with Morrison's blade. His small, snake eyes were open. He was still in his greasy uniform. His white, hairy belly showed through where I'd slashed at his shirt. He had been a big guy. To fit him in the trunk, they'd broken his legs, probably with a shovel. They'd broken them and folded them sideways at the knee to get his body in. I gazed at him and felt angry. He'd known, and he hadn't told me. But they'd killed him anyway. The fact that he hadn't told me hadn't counted for anything. They were panicking. They were silencing everybody while the clock slowly around to Sunday. I gazed into Spivey's dead eyes like there was information still in there. Then I ran back to the bodies on the edge of the copse and searched them. Two wallets and a car rental agreement. A mobile phone. That was all. The rental agreement was for the Buick, rented at the Atlanta airport Monday morning at 8, an early flight in from somewhere. I went through the wallets. No airline tickets. Florida driver's licenses, both with Jacksonville addresses. Bland photographs, meaningless names, credit cards to match. Lots of cash in the wallets. I stole it all. They weren't going to spend it. I took the battery out of the mobile phone and put the phone in one guy's pocket and the battery in the other's. Then I dragged the bodies over to the Buick and heaved them into the trunk with Spivey. Not easy. They weren't tall guys, but they were floppy and awkward. Made me sweat, despite the chill. I had to shove them around to get them both in the space Spivey was leaving. I scouted around and found their revolvers, both .38 caliber. One had a full load, the other had fired once. Smelled recent. I pitched the guns into the trunk, found the passenger's shoes. The Desert Eagle had blown him right out of them. I threw them in the trunk and slammed the lid. Walked back into the field and found my hiding place in the bushes, where I'd shot them from. Scrabbled around and picked up the two shell cases, put them in my pocket. Then I locked up the Buick and left it. Popped the Bentley's trunk, pulled out the bag with my old clothes in. My new gear was covered in red mud and streaked with the dead guy's blood. I put the old things back on, balled up the muddy, blood-stained stuff and shoved it in the bag, threw the bag in the Bentley's trunk and closed the lid on it. Last thing I did was use a tree branch to sweep away all the footprints I could see. I drove the Bentley slowly back east to Margrave and used the time to calm down. A straightforward ambush, no technical difficulty, no real danger. I had 13 years of hard time behind me. I should be able to walk through a one-on-two against amateurs in my sleep. But my heart was thumping harder than it should have been, and a cold blast of adrenaline was shaking me up. It was the sight of Spivey lying there with his legs folded sideways that had done it. I breathed hard and got myself under control. My right arm was sore, like somebody had hit my palm with a hammer. It jarred all the way up to the shoulder. That Desert Eagle had a hell of a recoil, and it made a hell of a noise. My ears were still ringing from the twin explosions. But I felt good. It had been a job well done. Two tough guys had followed me out there. They weren't following me back.